"What are you doing here, Kordach?"
Taur Ogas demanded coldly.
"I am on my master's business, Dread King," Brill replied.
"What business would Tuchik have in a place like this?"
"Something personal, Great King," Brill answered evasively.
"I like to keep track of you, and the other Dagashi, Kordach. When did you come back to Thormogos?"
"A few months ago,
mighty arm of Torek. If I had known you were interested, I would have sent word to you. The people my master wants me to deal with know I'm following them, so my movements aren't secret."
Taur Ogas laughed shortly, a sound without any warmth in it.
"You must be getting old, Kordach. Most Dagashi would have finished the business by now."
"These are rather special people," Brill shrugged.
"It shouldn't take me much longer, however. The game is nearly over. Incidentally, Great King, I have a gift for you."
He snapped his fingers sharply, and two of his henchmen came out of the building, dragging a third man between them. There was blood on the front of the captive's tunic, and his head hung down, as if he were only semi-conscious.
Barak's breath hissed between his teeth.
"I thought you might like a bit of sport," Brill suggested.
"I am the king of Thormogos, Kordach,"
Taur Ogas replied coldly.
"I am not amused by your attitude.
And I am not in the habit of doing chores for the Dagashi. If you want him dead, kill him yourself."
"This would hardly be a chore, Your Majesty," Brill said with an evil grin.
"The man's an old friend of yours."
He reached out roughly, grasping the prisoner's hair and jerking his head up for the king to see his face. It was Silk. His face was pale, and a deep cut on one side of his forehead trickled blood down the side of his face.
"Behold, the Trasnian spy, Keldar," Brill smirked. "I make a gift of him to your majesty."
Taur Ogas began to smile then, his eyes lighting with a dreadful pleasure.
"Splendid. You have the gratitude of your king, Kordach. Your gift is beyond price."
His smile grew broader.
"Greetings, Prince Keldar," he said, almost purring. "I have been waiting for the chance to see you again for a long time now. We have many old scores to settle, don't we?"
Silk seemed to stare back at the Murgo King, but Geryon could not be sure if he were conscious enough even to comprehend what was happening to him.
"Abide here a bit, Prince of Thrasnia,"
Taur Ogas gloated.
"I will want to give some special thought to your final entertainment. And I will want to be sure that you are fully awake to appreciate it. You deserve something exquisite, I think. Probably lingering. And I certainly would not want to disappoint you by rushing into it."
Chapter 22. Barak and Geryon slid back down into the gully, with the gravel rattling down the steep bank around them.
"They have got Silk," Barak reported quietly. "Brill is there. It looks as if he and his men caught Silk while he was trying to leave. They've turned him over to Taur Ogas."
Belgareth stood up slowly, a sick look on his face.
"Is he?"
He broke off.
"No,"
Barak answered.
"He's still alive. It looks as if they roughed him up a little, but he seemed to be all right."
Belgareth let out a long, slow breath.
"That's something, anyway." "Taur Ogas seemed to know him," Barak continued. It sounded as if Silk had done something that offended the king pretty seriously. Untaurogus looks like the kind of a man who holds grudges.
Are they holding him someplace where we can get to him?
Durnick asked.
We couldn't tell,
Geryon answered.
They all talked for a while, and then several soldiers took him around behind that building down there. We couldn't see where they took him.
The Murgle who runs the place said something about a pit.
We have to do something, Father.
I know, Paul, I know. We'll come up with something.
He turned toward Barak again.
How many soldiers did Taurogas bring with him?
A couple of regiments, at least. They're all over the place down there.
We could translocate him, Father,
Aunt Paul suggested.
That's a long way to lift something, Paul. Besides, we'd have to know exactly where he's been being held.
I'll find that out.
She reached up to unfasten her cloak. You'd better wait until after dark, he told her. There are not many owls in Skolmogos, and you would attract attention in the daylight. Did Taurogas have any Grolems with him?
He asked Geryon. I think I saw a couple.
Yeah, that's going to complicate things. Translocation makes an awful noise. We'll have Taurogas right on our heels when we leave.
Do you have any other ideas, Father?
Oh, let me work on it. At any rate, we can't do anything until it gets dark.
A low whistle came from some distance down the gully.
Who's that?
Barak's hand went to his sword.
Ho! Elons!
It was a hoarse whisper.
Methinks it is the Nadrak Yarblek,
Mandarallan said.
How did he know we were here?
Barak demanded. There was the crunching sound of footsteps in the gravel, and Yarblek came around a bend in the gully. His fur cap was low over his face, and the collar of his felt overcoat was pulled up around his ears.
There you are,
he said, sounding relieved.
Are you alone?
Barak's voice was heavy with suspicion.
Of course I'm alone,
Yarblek snorted.
I told my servants to go on ahead. You certainly left in a hurry.
We didn't feel like staying to greet Taurogas,
Barak replied.
It's probably just as well. I'd have had a great deal of trouble getting you out of that mess back there. The Murgle soldiers inspected every one of my people to be sure they were all Nadrak before they had let me leave. Taurogas has Silk.
We know. How did you find this?
You left the pegs pulled up at the back of my tent. And this hill is the closest cover on this side of the fair. I guessed which way you would go. And you left a track here and there to confirm it.
The Nedrak's coarse face was serious, and he showed no signs of his extended bout at the ale barrel.
We're going to have to get out of here. Taurogas will be putting out patrols soon, and you are almost in his lap. We must rescue our companion first,
Mandarallan told him.
Silk? You had better forget that. I'm afraid my old friend has switched his last pair of dice. I liked him, too.
Well, he's not dead yet, is he? Durnick's voice was almost sick.
No, not yet. Well, Taurogas plans to correct that when the sun comes up in the morning. I could not even get close enough to the pit to drop a dagger to him so he could open a vein. I am afraid his last morning is going to be a bad one.
Why are you trying to help us?
Barak asked bluntly.
You will have to excuse him, Yarblek. He is not familiar with Nadrak custom.
She turned to Barak.
He invited you into his tent and offered you his ale. That makes you the same as his brother until sunrise tomorrow.
Yarblek smiled briefly at her.
You seem to know us quite well, girl. I never got to see you dance, did I?
Perhaps another time.
Perhaps so.
He squatted and pulled a curved dagger from beneath his overcoat. He smoothed the patch of sand with his other hand and began sketching rapidly with his dagger point.
The Murgos are going to watch me, so I can't add half a dozen or so more people to my party without having them all over me. I think the best thing would be for you to wait here until dark. I will move out to the east and stop a league or so on the caravan track. As soon as it gets dark, you can slip around and catch up with me. We'll work something out after that.
Why did Taurugus tell you to leave?
Yarblick looked grim.
There's going to be a large accident tomorrow. Taurugus will immediately send an apology to Ran Borun. Something about inexperienced troops chasing a band of brigands and mistaking honest merchants for bandits. He will offer to pay reparation, and things will be all smoothed over. Pay is a magic word when you are dealing with the Tonedrans.
He's going to massacre this whole camp?
Barak sounded stunned.
That is his plan. He wants to clean all of the Westerners out of Skol Murgos, and he seems to think that a few accidents will do the job for him.
Relg had been standing to one side, his large eyes lost in thought. Suddenly he stepped across the gully to where Yarblek's sketch was. He smoothed it out of the sand.
Can you show me exactly where this pit in which they are holding our friend is located? It won't do you any good. It is guarded by a dozen men. Silka's got quite a reputation. And Taurugus does not want him to get away.
Just show me, Relg insisted.
Yarblek shrugged.
We are here on the north side.
He roughed in the fair and the caravan route.
The supply station is here.
He pointed with his dagger.
The pit is just beyond it at the base of that big hill on the south side. What kind of walls does it have? Solid stone. Is it a natural fissure in the rock, or has it been dug out? What difference can it make?
I need to know.
I didn't see any tool marks, and the opening at the top is irregular. It is probably just a natural hole.
Relg nodded.
And the hill behind it? Is it rock or dirt?
Mostly rock. All of stinking Skol Murgos is mostly rock.
Relg stood up.
Thank you,
he said politely.
You're not going to be able to tunnel through to him, if that is what you're thinking,
Yarblek said, also standing and brushing the sand off the skirts of his overcoat.
You don't have that time.
Belgareth's eyes were narrowed with thought.
Thanks, Yarblek. You have been a good friend. Anything to irritate the Murgos,
the Nadric said.
I wish I could do something for Silk. Don't give up on him yet. There's not much hope, I'm afraid. I had better be going, though. My people will wander off if I am not there to watch them.
Yarblek, Barak said, holding out his hand. Someday we will have to get together and finish getting drunk.
Yarblek grinned at him and shook his hand. Then he turned and caught Aunt Paul in a rough embrace.
If you ever get bored with these Alorns, girl, my tent flap is always open to you.
I will keep that in mind, Yarblek,
she replied demurely.
Luck, Yarblek told them. I'll wait for you until midnight.
Then he turned and strode off down the gully.
That's a good man there, Barak said. I think I could actually get to like him.
We must make plans for Prince Keldar's rescue,
Mandarallan declared, beginning to take his armor out of the packs strapped to one of the horses.
Or else failing, we must of necessity resort to main force.
You're backsliding again, Mandarallan, Barak said.
That's already been taken care of,
Belgareth told them, and Mandarallan stared at him.
Put your armor away, Mandarallan,
the old man instructed the knight. You are not going to need it.
Who's going to go get silk out of there, then? Barak demanded.
Ahim, Relg answered quietly. How much longer is it going to be before it gets dark?
About an hour. Why?
I'll need some time to prepare myself.
Have you got a plan, then? Dernick asked.
Relg shrugged.
There isn't any need. We'll just circle around until we're behind that hill on the other side of the encampment. I will go get our friend, and then we can leave.
Just like that?
More or less.
Please, excuse me.
Relg started to turn away.
Wait a minute. Shouldn't Mander Allen and I go with you?
You wouldn't be able to follow me,
Relg told him. He walked up the gully a short distance. After a moment, they could hear him muttering his prayers.
Does he think he can pry him out of that pit?
Barak sounded disgusted.
No, Belgareth replied. He's going to go through the hill and carry silk back out. That's why he was asking Yarblek all of those questions.
He's going to what?
You saw what he did at Prolgu, when he stuck his arm into the wall.
Well, yes, but
it is quite easy for him, Barak.
What about silk? How's he going to pull him through the rock?
I don't really know. He seems quite sure that he can do it, though.
If it doesn't work, Tar Urgas is going to have silk roasting over a slow fire first thing tomorrow morning. You know that, don't you?
Belgareth nodded somberly. Barak shook his head.
It is unnatural, he grumbled.
Don't let it upset you so much.
The light began to fade, and Relg continued to pray, his voice rising and falling in formal cadence. When it was fully dark, he came back to where the others waited.
I'm ready. We can leave now?
We'll circle to the west,
Belgareth told them.
We'll lead the horses and stay under cover as much as we can.
It'll take us a couple of hours, then,
Dernick said.
That's all right. It will give the soldiers time to settle down. Paul, see what the Grolems Geryon saw are up to.
She nodded, and Geryon felt the gentle push of her probing mind.
It's all right, father,
she stated after a few moments. They are preoccupied. Tar Urgas has them conducting services for him.
Well, let's go, then, the old man said.
They moved carefully down the gully, leading the horses. The night was murky, and the wind bit at them as they came out from between the protecting gravel banks. The plain to the east of the fair was dotted with 100 fires, whipping in the wind and marking the vast encampment of the army of Tar Urgas. Relg grunted and covered his eyes with his hands.
What's wrong?
Geryon asked him.
The fires. They stab at my eyes.
Try not to look at them.
My God has laid a hard burden on me, Belgarion.
Relg sniffed then, and wiped at his nose with his sleeve.
I'm not meant to be out in the open like this.
You had better have Aunt Paul give you something for that cold. It will taste awful, but you will feel better after you drink it.
Perhaps, Relg said, still shielding his eyes from the dim flicker of the Murgol watchfires.
The hill on the south side of the fair was a low outcropping of granite. Although aeons of constant wind had covered it for the most part with a thick layer of blown sand and dirt, the rock itself lay solid beneath its covering mantle. They stopped behind it, and Relg began carefully to brush the dirt from a sloping granite face.
"Wouldn't it be closer if you started over there?"
Beric asked quietly.
"There's too much dirt," Relg replied.
"Dirt or rock? What is the difference?"
"A great difference that you wouldn't understand."
He leaned forward and put his tongue to the granite face, seeming actually to taste the rock.
"This is going to take a while," he said.
He drew himself up, began to pray, and slowly pushed himself directly into the rock. Barak shuddered and quickly averted his eyes.
"What ails thee, my lord?"
Mandaralan asked. "It makes me cold all over just watching that," Barak replied.
"Our new friend is perhaps not the best of companions, but if this gift succeeds in freeing Prince Skeldar, I will embrace him gladly and call him brother."
"If it takes him very long, we're going to be awfully close to this spot when morning comes and Tar-Urgas finds out that Silk is gone."
"We will just have to wait and see what happens then," Dalgarath told them.
The night dragged by interminably. The wind moaned and whistled around the rocks on the flanks of the stony hill, and the sparse thorn bushes rustled stiffly. They waited. A growing fear oppressed Geryon as the hours passed. More and more he became convinced that they had lost Relg as well as Silk. He felt that same sick emptiness he had felt when it had been necessary to leave the wounded Leldorn behind, back in Arindia. He realized, feeling a bit guilty about it, that he had not thought about Leldoran in months. He began to wonder how well the young hothead had recovered from his wound, or even if he had recovered. His thoughts grew bleaker as the minutes crawled. Then, with no warning, with not even a sound, Relg stepped out of the rock face he had entered hours before. Astride his broad back and clinging desperately to him was Silk. The rat-faced little man's eyes were wide with horror, and his hair seemed to be actually standing on end. They all crowded around the two, trying to keep their jubilation quiet, conscious of the fact that they were virtually on top of an army of Murgos.
"I'm sorry it took so long," Relg said,
jerking his shoulders uncomfortably until Silk finally slid off of his back.
"There's a different kind of rock in the middle of the hill. I had to make certain adjustments."
Silk stood, gasping and shuddering uncontrollably. Finally, he turned on Relg.
"Don't ever do that to me again," he blurted.
"Not ever." "What's the trouble?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"I had feared we had lost thee, my friend," Mandaralan said, grasping Silk's hand.
"How did Bryl catch you?" Barak asked.
"I was careless. I did not expect him to be here. Ismin threw a net over me as I was galloping through a ravine. My horse fell and broke his neck."
"Hertha's not going to like that."
"I will cut the price of the horse out of Bryl's skin. Some place close to the bone, I think."
"Why does Tar-Urgas hate you so much?" Barak asked curiously.
"I was in Rakgoska a few years ago. A Tol'Nedrin agent made a few false charges against me. I never found out exactly why. Tar-Urgas sent some soldiers to arrest me. I did not particularly feel like being arrested, so I argued with the soldiers a bit. Several of them died during the argument. Those things happen once in a while. Unfortunately, one of the casualties was Tar-Urgas's oldest son. The king of the Murgos took it personally. He's very narrow-minded sometimes."
Barak grinned.
"He'll be terribly disappointed in the morning when he finds out that you have left."
"Oh, I know," Silk replied. "He'll probably take this part of Skarl Murgos apart, stone by stone, trying to find me."
"I think it is time we left," Dalgarath agreed.
"Oh, I thought you'd never get around to that," Silk said.
Chapter 23 They rode hard through the rest of the night and for most of the following day. By evening their horses were stumbling with exhaustion, and Geryon was as numb with weariness as with biting cold.
"We'll have to find shelter of some kind," Durnick said as they reined in to look for a place to spend the night.
They had moved up out of the series of connecting valleys through which the south caravan route wound, and had entered the ragged, barren wilderness of the mountains of Censorochthal Murgos. It had grown steadily colder as they had climbed into the vast jumble of rock and sand, and the endless wind moaned among the treeless crags. Durnick's face was creased with fatigue, and the gritty dust that drove before the wind had settled into the creases, etching them deeper.
"We can't spend the night in the open," he declared. "Not with this wind."
"Go that way,"
Relg said, pointing toward a rock fall on the steep slope they were climbing. His eyes were squinted almost shut, though the sky was still overcast and the fading daylight was pale.
"There's shelter there. A cave."
They had all begun to look at Relg in a somewhat different light since his rescue of Silk. His demonstration that he could, when necessary, take decisive action made him seem less an encumbrance and more like a companion. Belgarath had finally convinced him that he could pray on horseback just as well as he could on his knees, and his frequent devotions no longer interrupted their journey. His praying thus had become less an inconvenience and more a personal idiosyncrasy, somewhat like Mander Rollin's archaic speech or Silk's sardonic witticisms.
"You're sure there's a cave?"
Barak asked him. Relg nodded.
"I could feel it."
They turned and rode toward the rockfall. As they drew closer, Relg's eagerness became more obvious. He pushed his horse into the lead and nudged the tired beast into a trot, then a canter. At the edge of the rock slide, he swung down from his horse, stepped behind a large boulder, and disappeared.
"Looks as if he knew what he was talking about," Durnick observed. "I'll be glad to get out of this wind."
The opening to the cave was narrow, and it took some pushing and dragging to persuade the horses to squeeze through, but once they were inside, the cave widened out into a large, low-ceilinged chamber. Durnick looked around with approval.
"It's a good place."
He unfastened his axe from the back of the saddle.
"You'll need firewood."
"I'll help you,"
Geryon said.
"I'll go too," Silk offered quickly.
The little man was looking around at the stone walls and ceiling nervously, and he seemed obviously relieved as soon as the three of them were back outside.
"What's wrong?"
Durnick asked him.
"After last night, closed-in places make me a little edgy," Silk replied.
"What was it like?"
Geryon asked him curiously.
"Going through stone, I mean."
Silk shuddered.
"It was hideous.
We actually seeped into the rock. I could feel it sliding through me."
"It got you out, though," Durnick reminded him.
"I think I'd almost rather have stayed,"
Silk shuddered again.
"Do we have to talk about it?"
Firewood was difficult to find on that barren mountainside and even more difficult to cut. The tough, springy thorn bushes resisted the blows of Durnick's axe tenaciously. After an hour, as darkness began to close in on them, they had gathered only three very scanty armloads of wood.
"Did you see anybody?"
Barak asked as they re-entered the cave.
"No,"
Silk replied.
"Tor Urgas is probably looking for you."
"Oh, I'm sure of it."
Silk looked around.
"Where is Relg?"
"He went back into the cave to rest his eyes,"
Belgarath told him.
"He found water. Ice, actually. We will have to thaw it before we can water the horses."
Durnick's fire was tiny, and he fed it with twigs and small bits of wood, trying to conserve their meager fuel supply. It proved to be an uncomfortable night. In the morning, Aunt Paul looked critically at Relg.
"You don't seem to be coughing anymore," she told him. "How do you feel?"
"I'm fine,"
he replied, being careful not to look directly at her. The fact that she was a woman seemed to make him terribly uncomfortable, and he tried to avoid her as much as possible.
"What happened to that cold you had?"
"I don't think that it could go through the rock. It was gone when I brought him out of the hillside last night."
She looked at him gravely.
"I'd never thought of that," she mused. "No one has ever been able to cure a cold before."
"A cold isn't really that serious a thing, Balgara,"
Silk told her with a pained look.
"I'll guarantee you that sliding through rock is never going to be a popular cure."
It took them 4 days to cross the mountains to reach the vast basin Belgarath referred to as the wasteland of Murgos, and another half day to make their way down the steep basalt face to the black sand of the floor.
"What hath caused this, yours depression?"
Mandarallan asked, looking around at the barren expanse of scab rock, black sand, and dirty gray salt flats.
"There was an inland sea here once," Belgarath replied. "When Torak cracked the world, the upheaval broke away the eastern edge, and all of the water drained out."
"That must have been something to see," Barak said.
"We had other things on our minds just then."
"What's that?" Garion asked in alarm, pointing at something sticking out of the sand just ahead of them. The thing had a huge head with a long, sharp-toothed snout. Its eye sockets, as big as buckets, seemed to stare balefully at them.
"I don't think it has a name," Belgarath answered calmly. "They lived in the sea before the water escaped. They have all been dead now for thousands of years."
As they passed the dead sea monster, Garion could see that it was only a skeleton. Its ribs were as big as the rafters of a barn, and its vast, bleached skull larger than a horse. The vacant eye sockets watched them as they rode past. Mandarallan, dressed once again in full armor, stared at the skull.
"A fearsome beast," he murmured.
"Look at the size of the teeth," Barak said in an awed voice. "It could bite a man in two with one snap."
"That happened a few times," Belgarath told him, "until people learned to avoid this place."
They had moved only a few leagues out into the wasteland when the wind picked up, scouring along the black dunes under the slate-gray sky. The sand began to shift and move, and then, as the wind grew even stronger, it began to whip off the tops of the dunes, stinging their faces.
"We had better take shelter," Belgarath shouted over the shrieking wind. "This sandstorm's going to get worse as we move out farther from the mountains."
"Are there any caves around?"
Dernick asked Relg. Relg shook his head.
"None that we can use. They're all filled with sand."
"Over there,"
Barak pointed at a pile of scab rock rising from the edge of a salt flat.
"If we go to the leeward side, it will keep the wind off of us."
"No," Belgarath shouted. "We have to stay to the windward. The sand will pile up at the back. We could be buried alive."
They reached the rock pile and dismounted. The wind tore at their clothing and the sand billowed across the wasteland like a vast black cloud.
"This is poor shelter, Belgarath,"
Barak roared, his beard whipping about his shoulders.
"How long is this likely to last?"
"A day. 2 days. Sometimes as long as a week."
Dernick had bent to pick up a piece of broken scab rock. He looked at it carefully, turning it over in his hands.
"It's fractured into square pieces," he said, holding it up. "It'll stack well. We can build a wall to shelter ourselves."
"That will take quite a while," Barak objected.
"Do you have something else to do, then?"
By evening, they had the wall up to shoulder height, and by anchoring the tents to the top of it, and higher up on the side of the rock pile, they were able to get in out of the worst of the wind. It was crowded, since they had to shelter the horses as well, but at least it was out of the storm. They huddled in their cramped shelter for 2 days, with the wind shrieking insanely around them, and the taut tent canvas drumming overhead. Then, when the wind finally blew itself out and the black sand began to settle slowly, the silence seemed almost oppressive. As they emerged, Relg glanced up once, then covered his face and sank to his knees, praying desperately. The clearing sky overhead was a bright, chilly blue. Garion moved over to stand beside the praying fanatic.
"It will be all right, Relg," he told him.
He reached out his hand without thinking.
"Don't touch me,"
Relg said and continued to pray. Silk stood, beating the dust and sand out of his clothing.
"Do these storms come up often?" he asked.
"It is the season for them," Belgarath replied.
"Delightful," Silk said sourly.
Then a deep rumbling sound seemed to come from deep in the earth beneath them, and the ground heaved.
Earthquake! Belgareth warned sharply. Get the horses out of there!
Durnik and Barak dashed back inside the shelter and led the horses out from behind the trembling wall and onto the salt flat. After several moments, the heaving subsided.
It's Tuchik doing that, Soak demanded. Is he going to fight us with earthquakes and sandstorms?
Belgareth shook his head.
No. Nobody's strong enough to do that. That is what's causing it.
He pointed to the south. Far across the wasteland, they could make out a line of dark peaks. A thick plume was rising from one of them, towering into the air, boiling up in great black billows as it rose.
Volcano, the old man said. Probably the same one that erupted last summer and dropped all of the ash on Stithi's store.
A fire mountain?
Barak rumbled, staring at the great cloud that was growing up out of the mountaintop.
I've never seen one before.
That's 50 leagues away, Belgareth, Silk stated. Would it make the earth shake, even here?
The old man nodded.
The earth is all one piece, Silk. The force that's causing that eruption is enormous. It's bound to cause a few ripples. I think we had better get moving. Tarugas patrols will be out looking for us again, now that the sandstorm's blown over.
Which way do we go?
Durnik asked, looking around, trying to get his bearings.
That way.
Belgareth pointed toward the smoking mountain.
I was afraid you were going to say that, Barak grumbled.
They rode at a gallop for the rest of the day, pausing only to rest the horses. The dreary wasteland seemed to go on forever. The black sand had shifted and piled into new dunes during the sandstorm, and the thick, crusted salt flats had been scoured by the wind until they were nearly white. They passed a number of the huge, bleached skeletons of the sea monsters which had once inhabited this inland sea. The bony shapes appeared almost to be swimming up out of the black sand, and the cold, empty eye sockets seemed somehow hungry as they galloped past them. They stopped for the night beside another shattered outcropping of scab rock. Although the wind had died, it was still bitterly cold, and firewood was scanty. The next morning, as they set out again, Geryon began to smell a strange, foul odor.
What is that stink? He asked.
The tarn of Thoth, Belgareth replied. It's all that's left of the sea that used to be here. It would have dried out centuries ago, but it is fed by underground springs.
It smells like rotten eggs, Barak said.
There is quite a bit of sulfur in the groundwater around here. I would not drink from the lake.
I wasn't planning to, Barak said, wrinkling his nose.
The tarn of Thoth was a vast, shallow pond, filled with oily-looking water that reeked like all of the dead fish in the world. Its surface steamed in the icy air, and the wisps of steam gagged them with a dreadful stink. When they reached the southern tip of the lake, Belgareth signaled for a halt.
This next stretch is dangerous, he told them soberly. Do not let your horses wander. Be sure you stay on solid rock. Ground that looks firm quite often won't be, and there are some other things we will need to watch out for. Keep your eyes on me and do what I do. When I stop, you stop. When I run, you run.
He looked thoughtfully at Relg. The Ulgo had bound another cloth across his eyes, partially to keep out the light and partially to hide the expanse of the sky above him.
I'll lead his horse, Grandfather,
Geryon offered. Belgareth nodded.
It's the only way, I suppose.
He's going to have to get over that eventually, Barak said.
Maybe. But this is not the time nor the place for it. Let's go.
The old man moved forward at a careful walk. The region ahead of them steamed and smoked as they approached it. They passed a large pool of gray mud that bubbled and fumed, and beyond it a sparkling spring of clear water, boiling merrily and cascading a scalding brook down into the mud. At least it's warmer, Silk observed. Mandarallan's face was steaming perspiration beneath his heavy helmet.
Oh, much warmer, he agreed.
Belgareth had been riding slowly, his head turned slightly as he listened intently.
"Stop,"
he said sharply. They all reined in. Just ahead of them, another pool suddenly erupted as a dirty gray geyser of liquid mud squirted 30 feet into the air. It continued to spout for several minutes, then gradually subsided.
"Now," Belgareth barked, "run!"
He kicked his horse's flanks, and they galloped past the still-heaving surface of the pool, the hooves of their horses splashing in the hot mud that had splattered across the path. When they had passed, the old man slowed again, and once more rode with his ear cocked toward the ground.
"What is he listening for?"
Barak asked Polgara.
"The geysers make a certain noise just before they erupt," she answered.
"I didn't hear anything."
"You don't know what to listen for."
Behind them, the mud geyser spouted again.
"Garion?"
Aunt Paul snapped as he turned to look back at the mud plume rising from the pool.
"Watch where you're going."
He jerked his eyes back. The ground ahead of him looked quite ordinary.
"Back up,"
she told him.
"Durnick, get the reins of Relg's horse."
Durnick took the reins and Garion began to turn his mount.
"I said to back up."
Garion's horse put one front hoof on the seemingly solid ground, and the hoof sank out of sight. The horse scrambled back and stood trembling as Garion held him in tightly. Then, carefully, step by step, Garion backed to the solid rock of the path they had followed.
"Quicksand,"
Silk said with a sharp intake of his breath.
"It is all around us," Aunt Paul agreed. "Don't wander off of the path, any of you."
Silk stared with a revulsion at the hoofprint of Garion's horse disappearing on the surface of the quicksand.
"How deep is it?"
"Deep enough," Aunt Paul replied.
They moved on, carefully picking their way through the quagmire and quicksand, stopping often as more geysers, some of mud, some of frothy boiling water, shot high into the air. By late afternoon, when they reached a low ridge of hard, solid rock beyond the steaming bog, they were all exhausted from the effort of the concentration it had taken to pass through that hideous region.
"Do we have to go through any more like that?"
Garion asked.
"No," Belgareth replied. "It's just around the southern edges of the tarn."
"Can one not go around it then?"
Mandarallan inquired.
"It is much longer if you do, and the bog helps to discourage pursuit."
"What's that?"
Relg cried suddenly.
"What's what?"
Barak asked him.
"I heard something just ahead. A kind of click. Like two pebbles knocking together."
Garion felt a quick kind of wave against his face, almost like an unseen ripple in the air, and he knew that Aunt Paul was searching ahead of them with her mind.
"Murgos," she said.
"How many?"
Belgareth asked her.
"6. And a Grolem. They're waiting for us just behind the ridge."
"Only 6?
Mandarallan said, sounding a little disappointed. Barak grinned tightly.
"Light entertainment."
"You're getting to be as bad as he is," Silk told the big Kerrach.
"Thinkest thou that we might need some plan, my lord?" Mandarallan asked Barak.
"Not really," Barak replied. "Not for just 6. Let's go spring their trap."
The two warriors moved into the lead, unobtrusively loosing their swords in their scabbards.
"Has the sun gone down yet?"
Relg asked Garion.
"It's just setting."
Relg pulled the binding from around his eyes and tugged down the dark veil. He winced and squinted his large eyes almost shut.
"You're going to hurt them,"
Garion told him.
"You ought to leave them covered until it gets dark."
"I might need them,"
Relg said, as they rode up the ridge toward the waiting Murgo ambush. The Murgos gave no warning. They rode out from behind a large pile of black rock and galloped directly at Mandarallan and Barak, their swords swinging. The two warriors, however, were waiting for them, and reacted without that instant of frozen surprise which might have made the attack successful. Mandarallan swept his sword from its sheath, even as he drove his warhorse directly into the mount of one of the charging Murgos. He rose in his stirrups and swung a mighty blow downward, splitting the Murgo's head with his heavy blade. The horse, knocked off of his feet by the impact, fell heavily backward on top of his dying rider. Barak, also charging at the attackers, chopped another Murgo out of the saddle with three massive blows, spattering bright red blood on the sand and rock around them. A third Murgo sidestepped Mandaralan's charge and struck at the knight's back, but his blade clanged harmlessly off of the steel armor. The Murgo desperately raised his sword to strike again, but stiffened and slid from his saddle as Silk's skillfully thrown dagger sank into his neck, just below the ear. A dark-robed Grolem in his polished steel mask had stepped out from behind the rocks. Geryon could quite clearly feel the priest's exultation turning to dismay as Barak and Mandaralan systematically chopped his warriors to pieces. The Grolem drew himself up, and Geryon sensed that he was gathering his will to strike. But it was too late. Relg had already closed on him. The zealot's heavy shoulders surged as he grasped the front of the Grolem's robe with his knotted hands. Without apparent effort, he lifted and pushed the man back against the flattened face of a house-sized boulder. At first, it appeared that Relg only intended to hold the Grolem pinned against the rock until the others could assist him with the struggling captive. But there was a subtle difference. The set of his shoulders indicated that he had not finished the action he had begun with lifting the man from his feet. The Grolem hammered at Relg's head and shoulders with his fists, but Relg pushed at him inexorably. The rock against which the Grolem was pinned seemed to shimmer slightly around him. "Relg, no!" Silt's cry was strangled. The dark-robed Grolem began to sink into the stone face, his arms flailing wildly as Relg pushed him in with a dreadful slowness. As he went deeper into the rock, the surface closed smoothly over him. Relg continued to push, his arms sliding into the stone as he sank the Grolem deeper and deeper. The priest's two protruding hands continued to twitch and writhe, even after the rest of his body had been totally submerged. Then Relg drew his arms out of the stone, leaving the Grolem behind. The two hands, sticking out of the rock, opened once in mute supplication, then stiffened into dead claws. Behind him, Geryon could hear the muffled sound of Silk's retching. Barak and Mandaralan had by now engaged two of the remaining Murgos, and the sound of clashing sword blades rang in the chill air. The last Murgo, his eyes wide with fright, wheeled his horse and bolted. Without a word, Durnik jerked his axe free of his saddle and galloped after him. Instead of striking the man down, however, Durnik cut across in front of his opponent's horse, turning him, driving him back. The panic-stricken Murgo flailed at his horse's flanks with the flat of his sword, turning away from the grim-faced smith, and plunged at a dead run back up over the ridge, with Durnik close behind him. The last two Murgos were down by then, and Barak and Mandaralan, both wild-eyed with the exultation of battle, were looking around for more enemies.
"Where's that last one?" Barak demanded.
"Durnik's chasing him," Geryon said.
"We can't let him get away. He'll bring others."
"Durnik's going to take care of it," Belgoroth told him. Barak fretted.
"Durnik's a good man. But he's not really a warrior. Maybe I'd better go help him."
From beyond the ridge, there was a sudden scream of horror, then another. The third cut off quite suddenly, and there was silence. After several minutes, Durnik came riding back alone, his face somber.
"What happened? He didn't get away, did he?"
Durnik shook his head.
"I chased him into the bog. He ran into some quicksand."
"Why didn't you cut him down with your axe?"
"I don't really like hitting people," Durnik replied.
Silk was staring at Durnik, his face still ashen.
"So you just chased him into the quicksand, and then stood there and watched him go down? Durnik, that's monstrous."
"Dead is dead," Durnik told him, with uncharacteristic bluntness. "When it's over. Doesn't really matter how it happened now, does it?"
He looked a bit thoughtful.
"I am sorry about the horse, though."
Chapter 24 The next morning, they followed the ridgeline that angled off toward the east. The wintry sky above them was an icy blue, and there was no warmth to the sun. Rogue kept his eyes veiled against the light and muttered prayers as he rode to ward off his panic. Several times they saw dust clouds far out on the desolation of sand and salt flats to the south, but they were unable to determine whether the clouds were caused by Murgo patrols or vagrant wind. About noon, the wind shifted and blew in steadily from the south. A ponderous cloud, black as ink, blotted out the jagged line of peaks lying along the southern horizon. It moved toward them with a kind of ominous inexorability, and flickers of lightning glimmered in its sooty underbelly.
"There's a bad storm coming, Belgorath," Barak rumbled, staring at the cloud.
Belgorath shook his head.
"It's not a storm. It's ashfall. That volcano out there is erupting again, and the wind is blowing the ash this way."
Barak made a face and then shrugged.
"At least we won't have to worry about being seen once it starts."
"The Grolems won't be looking for us with their eyes, Barak," Aunt Paul reminded him.
Belgorath scratched at his beard.
"We will have to take steps to deal with that, I suppose."
"This is a large group to shield, Father,"
Aunt Paul pointed out,
"and that's not even counting the horses."
"I think you can manage it, Paul. You were always very good at it."
"I can hold up my side as long as you can hold up yours, old wolf."
"I am afraid I'm not going to be able to help you, Paul. Tuchik himself is looking for us. I have felt him several times already, and I'm going to have to concentrate on him. If he decides to strike at us, he will come very fast. I'll have to be ready for him, and I cannot do that if I am all tangled up in a shield."
"I can't do it alone, Father. Nobody can enclose this many men and horses without help."
"Geryon can help you."
"Me?"
Geryon jerked his eyes off of the looming cloud to stare at his grandfather.
"He's never done it before, Father,"
Aunt Paul pointed out.
"He's going to have to learn sometime."
"This is hardly the time or place for experimentation."
"He will do just fine. Walk him through it a time or two until he gets the hang of it."
"Exactly what is that I'm supposed to do?"
Geryon asked apprehensively. Aunt Paul gave Belgorath a hard look and then turned to Geryon.
"I'll show you, dear. The first thing you have to do is to stay calm. It really isn't all that difficult." "But you just said..." "Never mind what I said, dear. Now just pay attention." "What do you want me to do?" "The first thing is to relax," she replied. "And think about sand and rock. That's all. Just do that first. Concentrate."
He thought about sand and rock.
"No, Geryon, not white sand. Black sand. Like the sand all around us." "Well, you didn't say that." "I didn't think I had to."
Belgorath started to laugh.
"Do you want to do this, Father?"
she demanded crossly. And then she turned back to Geryon.
"Do it again, dear. Try to get it right this time."
He fixed it in his mind.
"That's better,"
she told him.
"Now, as soon as you get sand and rock firmly in your mind, I want you to sort of push the idea in a half circle out from you so that it covers your entire right side. I'll take care of the left."
He strained with it. It was the hardest thing he had ever done.
"Don't push quite so hard, Geryon. You're wrinkling it. And it's very hard for me to make the seams match when you do that. Just keep it steady and smooth." "I'm sorry."
He smoothed it out.
"How does it look, Father?"
she asked the old man. Geryon felt a tentative push against the idea he was holding.
"Yeah, not bad at all, Paul. Not bad at all. The boy's got talent."
"Just exactly what are we doing?"
Geryon asked. In spite of the chill, he felt sweat standing out on his forehead.
"You are making a shield," Belgorath told him. "You enclose yourself in the idea of sand and rock, and it merges with the real sand and rock all around us. When Grolems go looking for things with their minds, they are looking for men and horses. They will sweep right past us, because all they will see here is more sand and more rock."
"That's all there is to it."
Geryon was quite pleased with how simple it was.
There is a bit more, dear, Aunt Paul said. We're going to extend it now so that it covers all of us. Go out slowly, a few feet at a time.
That was much less simple. He tore the fabric of the idea several times before he got it pushed out as far as Aunt Paul wanted it. He felt a strange merging of his mind with hers along the center of the idea, where the two sides joined.
I think we've got it now, Father,
Aunt Paul said.
I told you he could do it, Paul.
The purple-black cloud was rolling ominously up the sky toward them, and faint rumbles of thunder growled along its leading edge.
If that ash is anything like what it was in the Issa, we're going to be wandering blind out here, Belgoroth,
Barak said.
Don't worry about it, the sorcerer replied. I have got a lock on Rachthol. The Gronums are not the only ones who can locate things that way. Let's move out.
They started along the ridge again as the cloud blotted out the sky overhead. The thunder shocks were a continuous rumble, and lightning seethed in the boiling cloud. The lightning had an arid, crackling quality about it as the billions of tiny particles seethed and churned, building enormous static discharges. Then the first specks of drifting ash began to settle down through the icy air as Belgoroth led them down off of the ridge and out onto the sand flats. By the end of the first hour, Geryon found that holding the image in his mind had grown easier. It was no longer necessary to concentrate all of his attention on it, as it had been at first. By the end of the second hour, it had become no more than tedious. To relieve the boredom of it as they rode through the thickening ashfall, he thought about one of the huge skeletons they had passed when they had first entered the wasteland. Painstakingly, he constructed one of them and placed it in the image he was holding. On the whole, he thought it looked rather good, and it gave him something to do.
Geryon, Aunt Paul said crisply, please do not try to be creative.
Oh, what?
Just stick to sand. Oh, the skeleton's very nice, but it looks a bit peculiar with only one side.
One side?
There wasn't a skeleton on my side of the image, just yours. Now keep it simple, Geryon. Don't embellish.
They rode on, their faces muffled to keep the choking ash out of their mouths and noses. Geryon felt a tentative push against the image he was holding. It seemed to flutter against his mind, feeling almost like the wriggling touch of the tadpoles he had once caught in the pond at Faldor's farm.
Hold it steady, Geryon, Aunt Paul warned. That's a Grolem.
Did he see us?
No.
There now, he's moving on.
And the fluttering touch was gone. They spent the night in another of the piles of broken rock that dotted the wasteland. Durnick once again devised a kind of low, hollowed-out shelter of piled rock and anchored down tent cloth. They took a cold supper of bread and dried meat and built no fire. Geryon and Aunt Paul took turns holding the image of empty sand over them like an umbrella. He discovered that it was much easier when they were not moving. The ash was still falling the next morning, but the sky was no longer the inky black it had been the day before.
"I think it's thinning out, Belgoroth," Silk said, as they saddled their horses. "If it blows over, we'll have to start dodging patrols again."
The old man nodded.
"We'd better hurry," he agreed. "There's a place I know of where we can hide, about 5 miles north of the city. I'd like to get there before this ashfall subsides. You can see for 10 leagues in any direction from the walls of Rachthol."
"Are the walls so high, then?"
Mandarallan asked. "Higher than you can imagine. Higher even than the walls of Vomimbre. 10 times higher, 50 times higher. You will have to see it to understand."
They rode hard that day. Geryon and Aunt Paul held their shield of thought in place, but the searching touches of the Grolems came more frequently now. Several times the push against Geryon's mind was very strong and came without warning.
"They know what we are doing, Father," Aunt Paul told the old man. "They are trying to penetrate the screen."
"Hold it firm," he replied. "You know what to do if one of them breaks through."
She nodded, her face grim.
"Warn the boy."
She nodded again, then turned to Geryon.
"Listen to me carefully, dear," she said gravely. "The Grolems are trying to take us by surprise. The best shield in the world can be penetrated if you hit it quickly enough and hard enough. If one of them does manage to break through, I'm going to tell you to stop. When I say stop, I want you to